All right, good morning, everybody. This is File 241, and it's October 20th. Just got done with the disaster drill. And who had lab this morning? Did that cut your lab short? Did that really hurt you guys in lab? Not too bad. You're pretty much done already? That's good. Okay. Fantastic. All right, so we're going to finish up sensory system, move on to endocrinology today. But I knew two lectures in endocrinology before the test. We're scheduled to have a test 1 week from today. That's pushing it a little tight, so I'm going to move the test off from 1 week to today to a week from Monday that's coming up. And I don't have the date handy. And Tuesday. Yeah, Tuesday. Thank you. So it's going to be a Tuesday. If somebody knows that date, I'll say it out loud. November 1st or November 2nd. There seems to be a little, and I don't want to close this program down November 1st, okay, because I don't know if I can get it back the way the system's been working. All right, so that's all I know about that. So look for another extra credit in lab for next week. I'll send it out over the weekend. Okay. All right, hopefully to help you with the test. All right, so we're talking about the retina. All right, you guys, let's listen up. Okay, if you got to finish some communication, please step outside, okay? All right, because I'm sure there's somebody close to you guys that want to listen to the lecture a little bit. All right, so we're talking about the retina, and make sure in lab that you review the anatomy of the eye. Make sure you know all the parts, all the layers. As a matter of fact, what are the three layers from superficial to deep? Sclera, which is the connective tissue layer. Then you have a vascular layer called the choroid. And then you have a neural layer called the retina, right? So that's what we're looking at right now, the deepest layer, the innermost lining of the eye. And as a matter of fact, the posterior part of the globe is the retina. And so here we see, sorry, I didn't set my mouse. Let me set my mouse so that it's available. Okay, so here we see the sclera, then the choroid, and then this is the retina. Of course, it's not to scale, all right, because these are big, huge, macroscopic cells. It's not quite this thick. And so light is coming in the cornea through the pupil, right, through the vitreous humor, and then it bumps into the retina. And as a matter of fact, this looks a little strange when you first look at it because the photoreceptor cells are not the superficial cells of the retina. They're actually the deep cells of the retina. So these rod-shaped cells and cone-shaped cells, these are the actual photoreceptors, which then release neurotransmitter on these bipolar cells, which then releases neurotransmitter on these ganglion cells. The ganglion cells then send action potentials to the brain. And as a matter of fact, do you recall what the visual cortex of the brain is? What has to receive depolarizations or action potentials in order for you to have the perception of light or vision? It is the occipital lobe, right? So all the way posterior part of the brain. And these cells right here, including the bipolars, process the light information to a high degree before it even gets to the brain. All right, and again, here we see these bipolar cells. And we said bipolar cells are sensory cells in the special organs, like vision and smell and things like that. Okay, now these two cells aren't drawn to scale, the rod cells and cone cells. The cone cells are actually a little bit smaller than the rod cells right here. All right, so here, this is a drawing that's a little bit better to scale. We see the cone cell and the rod cells, and they are sort of similar. We see that the inner segments right here contain cytoplasm and the nucleus, and it also contains like a little, almost something like an axon with synaptic endings on it, which releases neurotransmitter to either excite or inhibit the bipolar cells. And then the outer segment right here, we can see have a lot of different strata or lamina in them. So this is the laminated region. And this is the region that has the photoreceptors in it. And indeed, the cone cells are smaller than the rod cells. These laminations right here are what we call discs. And they're added to the outer segment from the inner segment right here. And then the outer segment is sloughed off. And part of the job of the choroid then is to recycle that material back to the body. Right, so these segments are regenerated all the time. And here's a nice micrograph that shows that the rod cells are real thick, but the cone cells are pretty thin. And that has something to do with the function of these cells. The rod cells collect a lot more light because they're thicker, so they work when the conditions of light are kind of dim, right? While the cone cells work under conditions of bright light. But because they're a lot thinner, that means that you have very high acuity vision with the cone cells and less acuity with the rod cells. So there's a trade-off. So rod cells give you coarse vision in dim light, and they only work for black and white and shades of gray. The cone cells give you very high resolution images in color. But the trade-off there is, in order to see in high resolution and color, you need bright light because these cells are so thin. All right, so that's the trade-off between these two cells. All right, so this area right here recycles the segments as they slough off of the rod and cone cells. It also absorbs excess light, like the choroid layer is dark, so that when light enters the eye, it doesn't bounce around inside the globe and re-excite some of these photoreceptor cells again. Right, and this pigment also then helps deliver nutrients that it gets from the choroid layer for these cells, because there really shouldn't be any blood cells or blood vessels in the retina. If there are, then it pushes these rod and cone cells out of the way, and guess what that produces? If you don't have a rod and cone cell in the retina, that produces a deficit, a vision deficit. So you'll have a blind spot in that area. And this area also provides for immune response, to fight tumors and bacteria and viral infections. And the ion level of the extracellular space around all these cells is very critical, and it helps adjust the extracellular ion concentrations as well. Okay, so how does a photoreceptor work? It has to have a pigment. And remember, a pigment is just any kind of chemical that can absorb light. That's basically a pigment. So, for instance, in the chairs that I see right here, they kind of look yellow to me, right? And they have pigments in them that absorb all the colors of the rainbow except for yellow. They reflect that back to your eye. So these chairs are absorbing, what, blue, indigo, violet, okay, green, but not the yellow color that's reflected back to us. So that's the job of a pigment. So different pigments absorb different colors and reflect then correspondingly different colors back to our eye. Yeah.
Blindness? Yes. Is that caused because we lose pigmentation color in our cones and rods, or is that like?
It could be due to degeneration of the retina, or it could be due to degeneration of any of the optic tracts that is carrying information to the brain, and I suppose it could even be due to damage to the occipital lobe of the brain itself. So you have to really diagnose and find out where the process is. Most commonly, it's a problem with the retina. And if I go back, we see that the retina is closely associated with the choroid, but there's not a lot of connective tissue that holds the retina up against the choroid, right? So the material moves from these blood vessels right here up into the retina by diffusion only. And what kind of distances does diffusion work best at? Long distances or short distances? Only short distances. So if there's a separation of the retina from the choroid, then these cells actually die. Okay, so head trauma that causes separation of the retina from the choroid will then produce blind spots, and hopefully it's not the whole retina, but if it is, then that whole eye will go blind as a result of that. Yeah.
What if we only had, has there been any cases where, humans have only had, one or the other in terms of cones and rods? Would that change our vision?
Yeah, it sure would. Okay, because if you don't have cone cells, then you will be colorblind. And you have different kinds of cone cells that allow you to see different kinds of color. So there's a variation in the population, especially in males, for color blindness. And depending on what cones are deficient, then you might be red-green colorblind or blue-black colorblind or totally colorblind. So it depends. Yeah, absolutely. So you need to have those cells in order to have 100% normal color vision. Right. All right, so let's get back to photoreception. Okay, you need to have photoreceptors. And this is what happens in rod cells. And what kind of vision do you have in rod cells once again? Black and white, right? Shades of gray. And these cells are thick, so they gather a lot of light. They're very sensitive to light. You can see in dim light, right? The rods are activated when light produces chemical changes in a compound that we call rhodopsin, right? Causing it to dissociate into retinol and opsin. So if we put retinol and opsin together, what do we get? Rhodopsin. All right, so here is a nice rhodopsin molecule. Come on, cursor. Here's a nice rhodopsin molecule with an opsin and a retinol kind of embedded in the active site. So again, these things match up together because of what? The shape of the molecules, right? And when this complex absorbs light, then the opsin and the retinol change configuration, they change conformation, and so they don't fit together anymore, and then there's a dissociation of this all-trans retinol from the opsin molecule, and that's going to change the permeability of the membrane of these rod cells to various kinds of ions. Now, what does that do to a cell when we change the permeability of the cell membrane to various ions? That could depolarize the cell, or it could hyperpolarize the cell, depending on the exact scheme that we're looking at. Okay, so when this rhodopsin absorbs light, it then indirectly causes a change in permeability to some ions in the membrane. But we got to be really familiar with that. All right, so let's look at some figures, and then maybe I'll come back and talk about some of these slides. All right, so here is an outer segment of a rod cell, right? And so here are one of the discs, and the rhodopsin inside of it, which contains the retinol molecule. Associated with this disc in the outer segment is a G protein. And what have you learned about G proteins? They can become activated and trigger various kinds of events inside the cell. All right, so in this particular case, in the dark, when there is no stimulation, all right, and here is the plasma membrane, all right. Here is a sodium channel, and this sodium channel, when in the dark, what can you tell me about this sodium channel in the absence of stimulus? Okay, the sodium channel right here, well, I would like to say, is it opened or closed? It's open, right? So in the dark, we have sodium entering the cell, and what the heck does that mean? It's being depolarized. Right, so this is a different kind of scheme than what you're familiar with. Usually we think of excitation as the result of some kind of stimulus, but in this particular case, this cell is being activated in what? The absence of stimulus. So this rod cell is depolarizing when there is no light. But in order for this channel to be opened, there has to be a cyclic GMP. Okay, and where do you think cyclic GMP comes from? Think of ATP and cyclic AMP. Yeah, so it comes from guanosine triphosphate, right? And it's through some kind of guanylate cyclase enzyme, okay? And here is a new enzyme that I don't think we've talked about before. Also in the cytoplasm is a phosphodiesterase. Have we ever talked about a phosphodiesterase in here? But this is another one that you have to memorize. A phosphodiesterase is an enzyme that can convert a cyclic AMP or a cyclic GMP into just a regular old GMP or a regular old AMP. It breaks the cyclic nature of that compound, so it changes the conformation of this cyclic GMP, so it can't fit into this binding site on the sodium receptor, all right, and then it will come off and that will close the sodium channel. All right, so phosphodiesterase, right, is normally inactive in the dark. Right, and since it's inactive in the dark, that maintains the level of cyclic GMP, which maintains the sodium current inside the cell, and that cell is depolarized as a result. So this current, right, when we have an electrical charge in motion across the membrane, that's really an electrical current, right, or you can physically think of it as a physical current of sodium entering the cell. We like to call that the dark current, because when does that occur? In the dark, right? So this cell depolarizes in the dark. All right, let's see what happens when we turn a light on. So a light is turned on, And then the retinol changes conformation from the cis configuration here to this all trans configuration. And when it does, it activates this G protein. And the alpha subunit can break away from the disc and bond to a phosphodiesterase, activating the phosphodiesterase enzyme. And remember, what does a phosphodiesterase do? It converts cyclic GMP into just regular old GMP right here. And when it does, then just by the law of mass action, right, then cyclic GMP is going to come off of that channel, right, and it's going to be converted into GMP. That closes the sodium channel. So the dark current is stopped causing hyperpolarization of a rod cell. All right, so that's half the story. Let's look at some more of the story. Look at this figure. So here is a really nice exam figure, which then kind of shows the whole scheme. So in the dark, right, one key thing that you should think of, in the dark, are there high levels of cyclic GMP or low levels of cyclic GMP in a rod cell? There are high levels, because if we go back to the previous slide, right, in the dark, phosphodiesterase is inactive, so there's high levels of cyclic GMP. And what does that mean? That means that it's going to bind to the sodium channel right here and keep it open. So this cell is becoming depolarized when this happens. When the cell depolarizes, right, then it can send action potentials or high-grade graded potentials to like this axon terminus right here, causing release of neurotransmitter. But remember, you learned of two general kinds of neurotransmitters. Sometimes they can cause excitation, or sometimes they can cause inhibition. And it just so happens that these rod cells, when they're stimulated in the dark, release neurotransmitter, right, because they're depolarizing, they release neurotransmitter, but the neurotransmitter to the bipolar cell is inhibitory. All right, so the visual system is really inhibited in the dark because the rod cells are excited in the dark because cyclic GMP can build up because phosphodiesterase, right, is not broken down. All right, so let's look and see what happens in the light. In the light, all right, then the phosphodiesterase becomes activated by that G protein because of the dissociation of retinol from opsin. Right, cyclic GMP gets converted to GMP, so the sodium channel closes. And so what happens to the cell? Does it continue to be depolarized? No, it becomes hyperpolarized. And when it becomes hyperpolarized, then it stops releasing neurotransmitter. And when it stops releasing, what kind of neurotransmitter is that? That's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So then that means that this bipolar cell right here becomes excited as a result of that and releases excitatory neurotransmitter on this ganglion cell right here. And then action potentials go to the brain, signifying what? That you have perceived light with this rod cell right here. All right, so this is a strange kind of system, right, where there is disinhibition of this bipolar cell, right, in the presence of a stimulus, but there's inhibition of this bipolar cell in the absence of stimulus, right? In the absence of stimulus, the rod cell depolarizes. In the presence of the stimulus, the rod cell hyperpolarizes, which is a different kind of scheme. But don't forget these two negative things kind of cancel out because, why? This is a inhibitory neurotransmitter. Yeah. Okay, in the light? All right, so in the dark, you have high levels of cyclic GMP. But in the light, the phosphodiesterase gets activated because of the dissociation of retinol from opsin, right? And the G protein then activates phosphodiesterase, which gets rid of cyclic GMP, and cyclic GMP is necessary to keep the sodium channel open. So when cyclic GMP goes away, the sodium channel closes. And when the sodium channel closes, that causes inhibition of the rod cell, so it won't release neurotransmitter. All right, but don't forget, this is an inhibitory neurotransmitter on the bipolar cell. So the bipolar cells, in the absence of the inhibitory neurotransmitter, will release an excitatory neurotransmitter, causing action potentials going to the brain. Right, so that stimulates the visual cortex as a result of that. Okay, so that's in the light. In the dark, don't forget, you have this dark current of sodium entering the cell. All right, so this is a pretty important kind of exam figure. And then you have the usual sodium-potassium pump operating all the time to maintain the proper membrane potential of these cells right here. So let's go back to a couple of these other slides right here. All right, so ganglion and amacrine cells produce action potentials. Rods and cones and bipolar and horizontal cells produce graded potential changes. The visual transduction is inverse to other sensory systems, right? Usually you think in the presence of a stimulus, that's when you would have depolarization taking place in the cell, but not for these rod cells, right? In the dark, photoreceptors release inhibitory neurotransmitter, because in the dark, the rod cells are depolarizing. In the dark, rod cells are depolarizing. They release inhibitory neurotransmitter that hyperpolarize the bipolar cells. So the bipolars won't release neurotransmitter. All right. When light is turned on, that inhibits the photoreceptors from releasing the inhibitory neurotransmitter. Thus, the bipolar cells are stimulated, and they release neurotransmitter that excites the ganglion cells, and the ganglion cells then send action potentials to the brain, to your visual cortex. Rods and cones contain many sodium channels that are open in the dark, and that produces something we call the dark current. Okay, and that's because sodium enters the cell, that depolarizes the cell. So in the dark, what is the nucleotide that is present that keeps the sodium channel open? It is cyclic GMP. Okay, but light, on the other hand, when light comes in and rhodopsin dissociates, that activates an enzyme that breaks down cyclic GMP. What's a general name of an enzyme that can break a cyclic nucleotide down? A phosphodiesterase, right? So the phosphodiesterase becomes activated as a result of an interaction with the G protein. So that sodium channel closes, and when the sodium channel closes, that hyperpolarizes the cell because those sodium channels are closed. And then the inhibitory neurotransmitter from a rod cell, right, stops being released, which then excites the bipolar cell. All right, so these two slides are pretty important to know. It's a nice synopsis, but a place to understand those slides is by looking at these illustrations right here. Yeah. Oh, you know what? There are no, let's see if I can show you something about that. In the dark, okay? Yeah. All right, so here's a ganglion cell which will eventually send action potentials to the brain, to the visual cortex. There's some signal processing in the brain before it gets to the visual cortex, but let's forget about that. So the ganglion cell is going to send action potentials to the brain. In the dark, right, let's maybe work backwards. In the dark, there is no excitatory neurotransmitter that's being released by this bipolar cell. And the reason why that is because in the dark, this bipolar cell is being inhibited by an inhibitory neurotransmitter from the rod cell, because in the dark, the rod cell is depolarizing. Because in the dark, there are high levels of cyclic GMP which bind to the sodium channel that keep it open. So sodium is entering the cell, stimulating the cell constantly in the dark, or depolarizing it, causing the release of this inhibitory neurotransmitter. So as soon as that cyclic GMP goes away, when light is present, okay, then that eventually is going to cause action potentials from this ganglion cell to go to the occipital lobe, the visual cortex. All right, so in the dark, your visual cortex is not receiving action potentials, even though this rod cell is depolarizing, because the rod cell releases an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It's not releasing an excitatory neurotransmitter. You know, if it was releasing an excitatory neurotransmitter, then eventually that would cause action potentials to go to the brain. But because the rod cell is releasing inhibitory neurotransmitters, there are no action potentials going to the brain.
But then you're saying in light, I'm thinking in light,
Well, even in the very, very dim circumstances, these rod cells are so big that it doesn't take a lot of light for them to, okay, for the dissociation of rhodopsin.
So basically,
there has to be some light. But cone cells are too small. You won't see hardly anything in dim conditions with cone cells. Yeah.
Thank you.
So there still has to be some light in order for these ganglion cells to send action potentials to the brain. If it's perfectly dark, you should not have any action potentials. But, you know, if it's perfectly dark, you still might see things because you're used to seeing things. And so your mind just might put little images in your perception. Okay. Think of those as like being little commercials. Okay. Okay, so that's for sensory system. Okay, so don't forget there was that synopsis of the labyrinth. Right, you should know the bony labyrinth, the membranous labyrinth, the receptor cells, and what were all the receptor cells for hearing and hair cells for kinetic equilibrium and static equilibrium, right? Just arranged a little bit differently inside the labyrinth to give you a different perception. Okay, let me see how I can close this thing down. Let me see, Control X. No, okay. We can do this window button. Do you see a window button? Top left. Like up over here?
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of handy. Let me see what I got right here. Oh, is there like an exit icon in here? Close. Yay, sort of closed. Okay, but that's okay. I need that program open because we're going to go to another lecture. We're going to go to endocrinology. Okay, and hopefully by next week I'll get a mouse pad that works really nice with this mouse right here.
I keep meaning to bring you one, but I forget as well.
Yeah. Okay, endocrine system. We talked about the nervous system, which can coordinate the body and send signals over long distances very rapidly. The endocrine system can send signals over long distances as well, but it's not nearly as rapid. And I think I mentioned this before. If the onset of an action of some kind of phenomena, if the onset is fast, the duration usually is very short. Okay? If the onset of action it takes time, if it's longer, then the duration is longer as well. So when you start to study some pharmacology, you'll see that's true for many pharmacologic agents. Right? The most dangerous ones are the ones that act very fast because you don't have time to counteract them. But one nice thing about fast-acting pharmacologic agents is that they don't last for a long period of time. So if you can support somebody's life that's in trouble for a short period of time, then that thing will clear their system very quickly. Right? But other drugs that take longer to take effect, that means that their duration of action will take longer. So the endocrine system, since it takes longer to have an effect, right, it will last for a longer period of time inside your body. All right, so let's look at some hormones. Let's go to next slide. Here we go. Okay. So here is a slide that shows the location of a bunch of endocrine glands in the body. So up here is the brain, and you're kind of familiar with the brain from anatomy, right? Like here's the corpus callosum right here. An important endocrine gland in the brain is the hypothalamus. And then just below and also the pineal gland, but we're going to focus mostly on the hypothalamus. Then the pituitary gland. Pituitary gland is connected to the hypothalamus right here via the infundibulum, or the pituitary stalk. And the pituitary gland then controls some other endocrine glands in the body, like the thyroid gland over here, and the adrenal gland. Right, and gonads, like testes and ovary. Right, there are other endocrine glands in the body that aren't directly controlled by the pituitary, like the pancreas. The pancreas monitors blood glucose levels, and then it's involved in the homeostasis of blood glucose. Okay, so we're going to look at, and the kidneys are an endocrine gland, right? But it's not controlled by the pituitary. All right, so endocrine glands are ductless glands that secrete hormones directly into the blood. And once they get in the blood, where do they go? All over the body, right? So the circulatory system distributes them. And a distant tissue can respond to a hormone if it has a receptor to that particular hormone. So if a tissue does not have a receptor, then it'll be completely unaware that there is that hormone or that signaling agent floating around in the blood. So it's got to have a receptor. All right? There can be something called neurohormones. These are chemical signaling molecules that are secreted into the blood specifically by modified neurons. All right? And we're going to see that happening in the hypothalamus right here. So instead of calling those things just plain old hormones, we'd like to call those neurohormones because they're secreted by neurons. And then if a tissue has a receptor, we call it a target tissue. It can be affected by the hormone. And when the hormone binds to a receptor in that target tissue, it's going to affect the behavior or the metabolism of that cell. All right, so it produces some kind of effect. But in order for a tissue to be affected by a hormone, what does it have to have? That's got to have a receptor, right? And how would you explain the binding of a hormone to its receptor? It's got to be complementary in shape, right? So there has to be an active site that's complementary to the physical structure of the hormone. Okay. Let's take a look at that. Also, here is a list of various endocrine glands in your body and the hormones that they secrete. We're going to talk about most of these things, some of them not in this particular chapter. Like, for instance, the heart is an endocrine gland. When we get to the cardiovascular system, we'll talk about this one. All right, they're not the whole heart, but at least the atria will release something called natriuretic hormone. All right, that will go to the kidneys, and it promotes the excretion of sodium in the urine. And water then has a tendency to flow along with that calcium just by osmosis. And so it acts like a diuretic. So that's one way to reduce fluid inside the body. Okay, and this is called natriuretic hormone because what does natrium mean? If you know that, then the action is kind of easy to understand. Natrium is sodium, right? So natriuretic hormone means that this is a hormone that promotes, right, the secretion of sodium into the urine, and as a result, you lose sodium. All right, so I think we're going to start to talk about some of these hormones right now. Let's see, do I have thyroid? Okay, some of these hormones work antagonistically with each other, right? And that shouldn't surprise you because antagonism is a really powerful tool for maintaining control and balance inside your body. Like, for instance, calcitonin and parathyroid hormone. Okay, are antagonistic to each other. One increases blood calcium, the other decreases blood calcium. All right, in the pancreas, some cells secrete insulin, which decreases blood glucose, and different cells, but again, still in the pancreas, will release glucagon that increases blood glucose. So the working of insulin and glucagon together will help maintain blood glucose homeostasis. Just like calcitonin and parathyroid hormone help maintain what? Calcium blood homeostasis. All right, so let's start looking at some of these things. Let's classify some hormones because that's going to help you understand how they act inside the body. There are amine hormones derived from tyrosine and tryptophan. These are essential amino acids that you have in your diet, right, which include norepinephrine and epinephrine. But what can you tell me about norepinephrine and epinephrine from the previous chapters? These are neurotransmitters, okay, but in some cases they can also be used as hormones, which means what? They don't just diffuse to a postsynaptic cell, they actually diffuse into a blood vessel via capillary and get transported everywhere in the body, in which case they'll have a much longer action compared to when they're used as a neurotransmitter. All right, some other amine hormones will be thyroxine and melatonin, thyroxine from the thyroid gland. Some are polypeptide or protein hormones, and so these are just chains of amino acids, and these include antidiuretic hormone. And what the heck does that mean, antidiuretic hormone? What does a diuretic do? Makes you lose water, right? Makes you pee. Antidiuretic hormone makes you retain water, okay? That's an important hormone. Growth hormone, insulin, oxytocin, glucagon, adrenal corticotropic hormone, and parathyroid hormone. These are all amino acid type hormones. Some can be glycoproteins, which means that they're a protein that's been modified by conjugating with a sugar molecule. Conjugation just means it's been added to it covalently, right? Like luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, and thyroid stimulating hormone. I'll be using these terms and you'll become familiar with these different hormones, but you won't be just by looking at this one slide. And then here's another class, steroid hormones. Steroids are what kind of compounds? They're lipids. And so what does that mean in terms of their overall physical chemistry? They are what? Hydrophobic compounds, right? So they don't like to be in water, but they can diffuse through cell membranes then very easily because they're lipids. But because they don't like to dissolve in water, a lot of these hormones then need a carrier molecule in your circulatory system so that it helps them dissolve in the blood. And so these things include testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, cortisol, and even some other compounds like thyroid hormone. Thyroxin is also lipophilic, all right, even though it's not a steroid. All right, and all of these hormones right here, the steroid hormones, are all derived from a base molecule of cholesterol. So you need to have at least some cholesterol in your body to make these signaling compounds here. So here is what cholesterol looks like. With a small modification, it can become pregnenolone, and then pregnenolone can be converted into progesterone. And have you ever heard of progesterone yet in your life? Yes, that's an important steroid hormone in females. There's no analog in the male physiology whatsoever. And it's secreted by the corpus luteum. So here is an ovary of a female. And there are many follicles. One or two of these follicles might mature every month to make a mature follicle that will ovulate an egg for fertilization. And the remnants of that follicle after it ovulates an egg is called the corpus luteum. And the corpus luteum is an important endocrine gland because it secretes progesterone, okay? All right, some of these other follicles will secrete things like estrogen. And we're going to see where estrogen comes from. All right, so progesterone, right, is the base molecule to make cortisol. And cortisol is what we call a glucocorticoid. It helps regulate glucose metabolism inside our cells. It's secreted by the adrenal cortex. So this is a pathway that's an active pathway in the adrenal cortex. All right, progesterone can also be used to make androstenedione, right, which sort of is an analog of a male steroid. And that can be converted into testosterone, which is the typical kind of male steroid. And then testosterone can be converted, right, into estrogen. All right, so females need to have some testosterone in their body, at least in this pathway right here, to make estrogen. And in this slide right here, notice here's an ovary, just like this ovary up over here. But now we see some follicles in the process of maturation, and I see a little egg or oocyte inside of a follicle. And as the follicle develops, the hormone that it mostly secretes is estrogen. And then once this follicle is mature and this egg is ovulated from the ovary, what does it become? What does this follicle, this structural follicle, become? Becomes the corpus luteum, and then the ovary stops secreting a lot of estrogen and starts to secrete a lot of progesterone at that time. All right, so that's going to be the last chapter that we're going to talk about, is the endocrine control of the reproductive system. But it's probably important to know a little bit about some of these hormones. All right, testosterone, on the other hand, if we have a nice cross-section of the testes right here, here's a seminiferous tubule that is responsible for spermatogenesis, but the cells outside of the tubule, sometimes we call these interstitial cells or cells of Leydig, these are the cells that actually secrete testosterone, which then promote all the secondary sex characteristics that we see in males. And testosterone is also important because spermatogenesis is dependent on testosterone. testosterone comes from these interstitial cells. Okay, so here is not a steroid hormone, but it still is lipophilic, which means it's hydrophobic, and it's a thyroid hormone, and it's called threonine. Right? When threonine is iodinated with these iodine elements right here, we call it thyroxine. And now this is going to be an active form of thyroid hormone, but that's not the most active form. Sometimes we just call this T4 or tetraiodothreonine. The active, we find a lot of this in the blood, but the active form is triiodothreonine, right? So it's missing an iodine molecule right here. So in this particular case, T4 is what we call a prohormone. Remember, a lot of enzymes and hormones are synthesized in an inactive form, and then when they get to their target tissue, they become activated into the active form. So T3 is the active form of the hormone. And because it is lipophilic, right, it can diffuse into the target cells. So where would you expect to have a receptor for this particular hormone right here? Since it can enter the cell, it doesn't need to be in the plasma membrane. It is inside the cell, right? And so lipid compounds like steroids and thyroid hormone can have receptors either in the cytosol or even inside the nucleus of the cell, because they can diffuse right through the cell. Okay, so let's see. Common aspects of neural and endocrine regulation. We talked about this a little bit. Both the nervous system and endocrine system use chemicals to communicate. The nervous system uses chemical synapses, right? The difference between neurotransmitters and hormones is transport in the blood. Hormones are transported in the blood. And hormones can have a greater diversity of effects, right, including growth and control of the reproductive system. Some chemicals can be used both as hormones and neurotransmitters. And can you give me a couple examples of a signaling compound, a signaling molecule that can be used both as a hormone and a neurotransmitter? Like epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay. Okay, the target tissues for both neurotransmitters and hormones must have a receptor someplace in order to elicit some kind of response, and both must be rapidly inactivated. All right, so why is that? What's a good way to think of why a signaling compound should be deactivated? Okay, so for instance, let's just say that we need to send a signal someplace to turn the lights on and off in this room. What do we typically use to turn lights on and off in a room? A light switch, okay? So you walk into a room, it's dark, you flip the light switch, okay? And how useful would that light switch be if you switched it on one time, okay, you could never use it again. The lights would be on forever. How good of a signaling device would that be then? It would not be very useful, because then you'd have to take it out and replace it every single time, right? So for receptors, the same thing is true. So there must be some way to deactivate it with a light switch. You just flip it the other way, and then you can do what? You can turn it back on. So these things should be cyclic in nature so that you can deactivate them, which means then that you can reactivate it at some period of time when it's appropriate. Okay. A tissue can respond to a number of different hormones. Why do you think that is? Why can a tissue respond to a number of different hormones? Because it's going to have a number of different receptors, right? Either in the cytoplasm or on the plasma membrane. So if two hormones work together to produce some kind of effect in the body, we call those synergists, right? If there are two hormones that work against each other, then they're going to be called antagonistic to each other. And as a matter of fact, there's something also important with this synergism right here. They're really synergistic if when they're added, one hormone might have an effect, okay? And then if we add a second hormone, the effect will be greater than just if the second hormone was applied by itself, right? So if we apply the first hormone and it has an effect of 2, and if we apply a second hormone all by itself, it has an effect of 2. So usually if we put the two effects together, we would have what? An effect of 4, but if it's really synergism, with both hormones together, you might have an effect of 5 or 10 or something. So the magnitude of the response of that target cell will be much greater, right, than just the simple sum of the activities of the individual hormones. Okay, here's another case that can happen too. A hormone might not have any effect, right, except when there's the presence of a second hormone. Right, so the first hormone won't have any effect unless the second hormone is present, and we call that the permissive effect of the second hormone. So if it enhances the responsiveness of a target organ, right, then it has a permissive effect. And sometimes we need to have hormones in combination to change the physiology inside the cell. And we're going to see some examples of that. All right, mechanisms of hormone action. You should think of an enzyme or even a receptor, okay, because, well, actually, in order for a hormone to have an action, the target cell has to have a receptor. So there is specificity. So what does that mean? Target cell has receptors that show specificity. It just means that a signaling compound has to have the right shape to fit into the active site of that receptor. And if that little ligand molecule or hormone changes shape a little bit, it won't bind to the receptor and it won't elicit a response in the target tissue. And because the shapes are so nice, they fit together so well, there's high affinity, right? High affinity so that their hormones just really love to bind to receptors because they fit together so nicely. And because there's high affinity, right, then there's low capacity for a hormone, which means that you need very little hormones in your body to change the physiology of target tissues. All right, some other mechanisms. Lipophilic hormones have receptors in the target cytoplasm or maybe in the nucleus because they can diffuse through the plasma membrane. Right? If the target is inside the nucleus, then it's going to affect transcription. Then hormones, when they bind, can actually become transcription factors. And who can recall something about transcription? Protein synthesis, that's right. So it can activate the nucleus. It can convert DNA to RNA, which is a precursor step to translation, right? So these hormones can actually cause the buildup of certain kinds of proteins inside the cell. These could be structural features of a cell, like maybe membrane channels or other kinds of enzymes, physiologic features of the cell directly. We call this the genomic action of a steroid or a thyroid hormone. Right, but since the cell has to build proteins, right, it is relatively slow. It takes at least 30 minutes for the effect of a lipophilic hormone to have an effect inside your body. Okay, so it's relatively slow. But what about the duration? Once that protein is made, then it can exert an effect inside that cell for a relatively long period of time, even though it takes a long time to take an effect. Receptors for water-soluble compounds, where would you guess they have to be? Water-soluble hormones, can they diffuse into the cell? No, because the membrane is hydrophobic, so the receptor has to be on the plasma membrane. And then there has to be some kind of transduction scheme to convert the signaling molecule that's on the outside of the cell to some kind of signaling molecule that's on the inside of the cell. And what do we invoke to talk about that kind of scheme, where you have some kind of molecule, signaling molecule, that's trapped outside the cell that causes a buildup of a signaling molecule inside the cell, like the second messenger system. So the molecule outside the cell is always considered the first messenger, and then the buildup of the second molecule inside the cell is the second messenger. So there doesn't have to be a physical transport of material from inside to outside the cell. Right, so water-soluble hormones act through second messengers, and the effect is relatively quick. And in a few cases, there are some steroid hormones that do work with cell surface receptors, and in that case, we would call that the non-genomic action. In that particular case, then they're not going to affect transcription or protein synthesis. They're going to affect metabolism by maybe activating or deactivating some enzymes inside the cell. All right, so let's look at some lipophilic hormones. Now, a lipophilic hormone, does it like to dissolve in blood or not? Lipophilic is the same thing as hydrophobic. If it's hydrophobic, it doesn't like to dissolve in water. All right, so there has to be a special little scheme to dissolve lipid compounds in plasma, which is basically an aqueous or a water solution. What would you do at home? So you got some butter on your shirt. What would you do to get that butter off your shirt? You just can't throw it in the washing machine and turn your washing machine on. What would you have to add to it? Yeah, like soap, like a detergent. So there has to be a molecule that can bind to that hormone, right, which has some lipophilic part to it, but the other part of the molecule is hydrophilic, and that allows that hormone to dissolve in the plasma. We call that a carrier protein. And these carrier proteins have a little active site that can bind the hormone, right? And so that helps dissolve the hormone in the bloodstream, right? But there's always going to be some hormone dissolved in the blood, and this is just going to be like a little chemical reaction at equilibrium. So if we decrease the amount of hormone that's in the blood, what's going to happen to the amount of hormone that is bound to this carrier protein? Just by the law of mass action or by Le Chatelier's principle, what's going to happen? Then it's going to dissociate to try to replace some of this hormone that's in the blood. Or if blood hormone levels, just this free hormone concentration goes way up, that's going to do what? That's going to increase the amount of hormone bound to carrier protein. So hormone bound to carrier protein kind of acts like a little reservoir that maintains sort of like a constant concentration of hormone in the blood. And if it's in the blood like this, what can it do? Easily diffuse inside the cell. Okay, when it diffuses inside the cell, guess what happens? And that causes a little bit of dissociation right here, which maintains the concentration in the plasma. All right, once it's inside the cell, it can bind to a receptor. And so here is a receptor protein. Hormone binds to this thing, and then this complex translocates into the nucleus, and this receptor binds to DNA, and then it can activate a gene for transcription somewhere down along the DNA molecule. All right, so what does transcription produce? Transcription converts information in DNA into what? Information in RNA, and in particular messenger RNA. And then that messenger RNA leaves the nucleus, goes into the cytoplasm, where it can join with a ribosome, and that information in messenger RNA can be used to make a protein. All right, so what do we call this process of taking information from messenger RNA and converting it into protein information? That's translation, yeah, and that happens in the cytoplasm, right? And that protein then is going to change the physiology of the cell, right? So, and we call that a response. Then the cell responds to this particular hormone right here through the process of transcription and translation. Let's look at this in a little bit more detail. All right, so nuclear hormone receptors, which is what this thing is right here. This is a nuclear hormone receptor because it's going to have an effect inside the nucleus. All right, are transcription factors. When bound to hormones, they activate transcription. Here's my cursor once again. All right, so there are thousands and thousands of different kinds of nuclear hormone receptors in the body, which bind different kinds of steroid hormones, as well as thyroid hormone. Remember, thyroid hormone is lipophilic, right? As well as some other compounds like vitamin D and retinoic acid. We're going to see how these play a role in a little bit. Okay, so here is that nuclear hormone receptor. It's got two domains, right? It's got a ligand binding domain, and the ligand binding domain binds the steroid hormone, and then it has a DNA binding domain right over here that can attach to what compound in your body? DNA, okay? Okay, and when this nuclear hormone receptor binds this hormone, right, then this receptor protein can bind to a DNA molecule, but look at this hormone response element right here. So I see it in light blue, and How many of these, how many sites does it have? I see two, because it's separated by this dotted line. And each one of these sites can bind a nuclear hormone receptor. All right, so let's look down over here. So in this particular case, right, the two half sites have nuclear hormone receptors bound to it, right? And we call this dimerization of the receptor. And when dimerization takes place, then transcription can begin, right? But if only one half site binds the hormone, the nuclear hormone receptor, transcription will not take place, right? If the dimer is the same on both sides, if it's the same hormone, we call that a homodimer. If it requires different hormones, we call that a heterodimer. All right, let's talk about the thyroid a little bit. Because remember, the thyroid is lipophilic. It's going to work through nuclear hormone receptors. The thyroid gland secretes about 90% of tetraiodothreonine, which is T4, and about 10% T3. And T3 is the active form of the hormone, right? And most of the hormone that's in the blood, 99%, is T4. And it's bound to carrier proteins, which we call the thyroid binding globulin. So TBG is like the little transportation mechanism. It's like a little detergent that allows T4 to dissolve in blood. Right? But only free T4 can enter cells, so the bound acts like a reservoir. So as soon as the T4 gets absorbed by a cell or diffuses into a cell, then some is released from thyroid binding globulin. T4 is relatively inactive inside the cell, and so we call that a prohormone. When it enters the cell, it's converted into T3 by cleaving off one of the iodine molecules, right? And that's the active form. So T3 then binds to the receptor protein, which is located inside the nucleus. So it's not a cytoplasmic receptor, but it's a nuclear receptor. And guess what is the effect of T3 when it binds to the receptor protein located inside the nucleus? What's it going to do? It's going to act like a transcription factor, so it's going to allow certain kind of protein synthesis to take place that would not normally take place. Okay. All right, so T3 and the receptor bind to one half site. So here we see triiodothreonine on this nuclear receptor right here. The other half site has to bind retinoic acid. All right, so retinoic, and we see the shape of the active site on this receptor is different. All right, so here's retinoic acid, and it forms a dimer. But in this particular case, what is this dimer? Is this a heterodimer or a homodimer? It's a heterodimer, right? So in order for T3 to have an effect on the cell by causing transcription, right, retinoic acid has to be present. So this is an example of what? The permissive effect of retinoic acid on the expression of T3 with inside the cell, okay? Because these heterodimers have to form first, and then that's going to stimulate transcription as a result of that. So don't forget about that permissive effect of certain hormones. Water-soluble hormones use cell surface receptors because they can't pass through the cell membrane, and they're activated by second messenger systems, right? The hormone is the first messenger, and the second messenger then builds up inside the cell through various kinds of mechanisms, which we're going to look at. Okay, so here's a scheme that uses adenylate cyclase. So here we have just a nice phospholipid bilayer, plasma membrane, okay? But don't forget, cells can insert various kinds of proteins inside the cell membrane because the best model is what, the fluid mosaic model. Various proteins can be added. One of the proteins that can be added to a cell membrane is adenylate cyclase. And I think this was on a list way back when of something you had to know, but we haven't really studied it yet, I don't think. Adenylate cyclase is an enzyme that can take adenosine triphosphate and convert it into cyclic AMP, breaking off two phosphate molecules. Right? And this is a special kind of AMP because it's cyclic in nature. So it has a special kind of shape. All right, so how does this adenylate cyclase become activated? Right? It becomes activated when this receptor right here, which is an extracellular receptor, binds a hormone, and this is a G protein coupled receptor. When the receptor binds a hormone, it activates the G protein, and the beta and gamma dissociates from the alpha subunit. The alpha subunit can diffuse around and wander around just by diffusion through the cell membrane, and when it bumps into adenylate cyclase, it activates it. All right, so when is adenylate cyclase activated? When there is the presence of hormone binding to the receptor, right? So adenylate cyclase becomes activated through this G protein coupled receptor. All right, and when cyclic AMP builds up inside the cell, right, there's a protein kinase right here that is inactivated because there's an inhibitory subunit bound to it. But when cyclic AMP binds, right, it takes off the inhibitory subunit, and so what happens to this protein kinase then? It becomes activated. And what's the job of a protein kinase? It runs around phosphorylating different kinds of proteins, right? Which then can change the active site of these proteins when it becomes phosphorylated, because a phosphorus is a pretty big molecule, changes the conformation of that active site. And so certain enzymes can be activated, right? And other enzymes can be inactivated, so that drastically changes the metabolism inside the cell. We're going to look at one particular example before we're done with this chapter. All right, so this actually can happen relatively rapidly, even though the hormone can't enter the cell, because what can you tell me about adenylate cyclase when it converts an ATP into a cyclic AMP? What can you tell me about adenylate cyclase? Okay, as long as this alpha subunit is bound to it, does adenylate cyclase get used up during the reaction? It sure doesn't, right? Because that's it can catalyze the reaction over again, and over and over and over and over and over again. So you can have hundreds or thousands of cyclic AMP molecules, which is what messenger? It's the second messenger that builds up inside the cell. You can have thousands of second messengers build up inside the cell as a result of how many messengers outside the cell? Just one. So we call that what? Amplification. So this is nice signal amplification. Okay? And then that can activate a protein, this protein kinase right here. And after a protein kinase promotes a reaction one time, what happens to this protein kinase? Does it get used up? No. It can then phosphorylate more enzymes with inside the cell. And so here is another level of amplification inside the cell. So when you have multiple levels of amplification, which means that you can have a huge change of the metabolism inside the cell as a result of just a single hormone binding to this cytoplasmic receptor, we call this a cascade mechanism, right? You have a number of steps of amplification, which means that this effect can happen very quickly, and it can cause a major change inside the cell, okay, because of this cascade mechanism. Okay, so make sure you know that the action of adenylate cyclase will make a cyclic AMP. Now, there's another enzyme that's inside the cell that's not on this slide, but you shouldn't forget that it's there, even though it's not on this slide. There's another enzyme that's going to break cyclic AMP down, because this shouldn't stay inside the cell forever, right? That would be like flipping a light switch one time, and then you're stuck with the lights on for the rest of your life, right? So cyclic AMP should actually be degraded inside the cell so that the system then can be activated once again under the proper circumstances. Can you remember the name of the enzyme that is continuously breaking down cyclic AMP inside the cell? Okay. And we look at it back in the senses chapter for the first time, and that's called a phosphodiesterase. Phosphodiesterase. So write that down on this slide someplace. All right, cyclic AMP can be converted into AMP with what? Phosphodiesterase. And so it's the antagonistic effects of adenylate cyclase and phosphodiesterase that maintain proper levels of cyclic AMP inside the cell, which maintains the proper physiology inside the cell, or the proper biochemistry. Okay, phosphodiesterase. Ooh, what do we have right here? Oh, here it is on the slide. All right, so phosphodiesterase. All right, cyclic AMP is inactivated by phosphodiesterase. Okay, here is another scheme. Besides from cyclic AMP, okay, here we have another what? G protein coupled receptor. And this G protein becomes activated when a hormone binds to the receptor. These G proteins dissociate and diffuse around inside the cell. And if a subunit of the G protein bumps into another enzyme instead of adenylate cyclase, if it's phospholipase C, okay, it's going to produce something called inositol 3-phosphate. But you could just call it IPI3. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to just call it IPI3. It's not important for you to know the structural formula or the conformation. Just know it is IPI3. Okay. So what do you think phospholipase does, just by knowing some nomenclature? Phospholipase, a lipase breaks down a lipid. Now, where are you going to get lipids from? Oh, the phospholipid bilayer. Oh, gee, that's pretty convenient, right? So here you have a substrate for phospholipase C. It's actually what? The structural component of the cell membrane, right? So this is a whole other little world, right? Here's water world inside the cell, and here you have lipid world inside the cell membrane, right? So the cell membrane not only makes the structure, the plasma membrane of the cell, but it is also what? A substrate that can make an important second messenger for the cell. That should sort of remind you of water, right? Because water is not just the solvent that we're dissolved in, but it participates in many chemical reactions of your body. It's just an interesting biochemistry of life. So phospholipase 3 makes IPI3 right here. IPI3 then diffuses to the endoplasmic reticulum. And in some cells, endoplasmic reticulum is a reservoir for calcium. And where is calcium usually at a high concentration? Outside the cell, not in the cytoplasm, but it can also be at high concentration, sequestered away from the cytoplasm and endoplasmic reticulum. But in this particular case, if IPI3 bumps into the endoplasmic reticulum, it will release calcium into the cytoplasm, and hence calcium is an important second messenger. It can be used to change the physiology of the cell. All right, so we're going to stop right here and finish up next time, maybe. I'm not sure. Okay, so look at adenylate cyclase, phosphodiesterase, and phospholipase C. Make sure you know the definitions of those enzymes.